This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli from Broadcasting and Cable Magazine and TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. This week, the American Film Institute issued its latest list of 100 great American films. The AFI has done that before, but this time, it's a list with a twist. Instead of 100 classic films ranked from top to bottom, this new list honors what it considers the top 10 films in 10 different genres: gangster movies, animation, science fiction, mysteries, westerns, and a lot more. Today we feature interviews with actors and one writer from several films on that list. Our first guest, Eva Marie Saint, co-starred opposite Cary Grant in Alfred Hitchcock's North by Northwest, playing a glamorous spy. That 1959 film, which ended with a cliffhanger on a cliff that happened to be Mount Rushmore, was voted one of the top 10 mystery movies. Eva Marie Saint's first film role was playing opposite Marlon Brando in On the Waterfront, for which she won an Academy Award. Terry spoke with her in 2000.
Let's talk about a movie that you made 5 years after On the Waterfront, North by Northwest, which starred you and Cary Grant. And you play the opposite kind of woman in this as you from what you played in On the Waterfront. In this, you're a very glamorous, beautiful spy working undercover, and it's your job both to seduce Cary Grant and to seduce his nemesis. Why don't we start with a scene from the movie? Cary Grant is on the run. He's been mistakenly accused of being a murderer. He's hiding out on a train. He's seated next to you in the dining car, and he doesn't know that you're a spy, and he doesn't know that you know that he isn't who he pretends to be. So
it's complicated, isn't it?
Here's the scene.
Think how lucky I am to have been seated here.
Well, luck had nothing to do with it.
Fate?
I tipped the steward $5 to seat you here if you should come in.
Is that a proposition?
I never discuss love on an empty stomach.
You've already eaten.
But you haven't.
Don't you think it's time we were introduced?
I'm Eve Kendall. I'm 26 and unmarried. Now you know everything.
Tell me, what do you do besides lure men to their doom on the 20th Century Limited?
I'm an industrial designer.
Jack Phillips, Western Sales Manager for Kingby Electronics.
No, you're not. You're Roger Thornhill of Madison Avenue, and you're wanted for murder on every front page in America. And don't be so modest.
Whoops.
Oh, don't worry. I won't say a word.
How come?
I told you. It's a nice face.
Is that the only reason?
It's going to be a long night.
True.
And I don't particularly like the book I've started.
Ah.
You know what I mean?
Let me think. Yes, I know exactly what you mean.
Eva Marie Saint, how did Hitchcock think of you for this very seductive role when you were best known for playing a woman who was very chaste and plain and, well, chaste and beautiful, but shy, you know, in On the Waterfront?
I don't know. I'm glad that he did. I felt very comfortable playing the role. His set was such that everyone who was on the set, you just had the feeling of such confidence because he saw you and he didn't see anyone else. And right, you can do this. Sure, you're right. You're the sexy spy lady. He didn't give much direction, very different from Kazan. He gave external direction, things like lower your voice, don't use your hands, because I sort of use my hands a lot when I talk, and look directly into Cary Grant's eyes at all times, which was not difficult. but those were the things, and the clothes. He didn't like the clothes that were designed for me, so he took me to New York, and we went to Berghoff Goodman, and he said, anything you want. I used to tease him. I said, you were the only sugar daddy I ever had in my life. I had none before or none after. That afternoon, I felt like I had a sugar daddy. Whatever you want, Eva Marie. And so I took the black dress with the red roses. Remember that? I love that and some other things.
Let's talk about the Mount Rushmore scene where you and Cary Grant are escaping from the people who are out to get you, and you're scaling Mount Rushmore, or what I imagine was a sculpture version, a miniature
exactly.
version of Mount yeah. Rushmore. What were you actually climbing on?
We were climbing at, by the way, 2 weeks after I gave birth.
Oh, you're
climbing
kidding.
No. But that was at MGM in the studio, and it was very, very high, and it was, you know, it was made of artificial material to make it look like Mount Rushmore, and it was high. I know, an actor who had trouble with heights would have had a difficult time, but I was pretty athletic in high school and college, and so I ski and all that, so I was in good shape, even though I'd had a baby, to climb that darn mountain. And I didn't have any fears. But once we started climbing and I happened to look down and I saw that the prop man was putting all these mattresses around the perimeter of the Mount Rushmore, and I thought, oh, my God, that's right. We could actually fall, couldn't we? And I remember at one point taking off my heels. As prepared as Hitchcock was, he didn't say, now, even once you get started, you take off those heels. Well, sure enough, I finally took off those heels after I broke a heel on one of the shoes.
Yeah, but you're climbing in your heels for part of it,
I know,
aren't you?
For a lot of it, yeah. And Cary Grant was older, and I thought, well, if he can do it, I can do it. But someone pointed out at one point I was really ahead of him. I was pulling him, or at least I was ahead.
There's the scene where you've kind of fallen off a ledge of the monument, and you're dangling off the edge of the monument. The only thing you have to hold on to is Cary Grant's hand, mm-hmm. but he's losing his grip, and you're in danger of just falling and falling. What was beneath you at that time, the mattresses?
Yes, and something to I was just, you know, we won't tell everybody, but just a few feet off a box or something. But at one point, I actually did slip further than I was supposed to, because the man who was supposed to catch me was looking the other way. So I slipped about 3 feet more than I should, and I still have a tiny scar on my left elbow. And if you notice in the movie, I actually rubbed my elbow, and I decided, the Actors Studio, it hurts, it really hurts, I don't want to stop filming, I don't want to yell cut, the actor never does that, and I just used it, and there I am in the scene, really rubbing my elbow, which hurt a good deal.
Eva Marie Saint, talking with Terry Gross in 2000. The next film we're saluting from the American Film Institute's new list of top 10 movies in 10 different genres is Chinatown, from the mystery category. In a few minutes, we'll hear from Faye Dunaway, who co-starred in the film. But first, we'll hear from its author, Robert Town. In the 1970s, Robert Town was brought in as a script doctor for Bonnie and Clyde and The Godfather, and he wrote the screenplays for The Last Detail, Shampoo, and Chinatown. Terry spoke with Robert Town in 1988.
You wrote the screenplay for Chinatown. Roman Polanski directed it. Polanski played a small role in the film. He played the part of a henchman who's hired to intimidate Nicholson to get off the case. And what Polanski does is take out a pocket knife, stick it into Nicholson's nose, and basically slit his nostril open. The line that you gave him to say was, "Know what happens to nosy fellows? They lose their noses." Why did you want to cut the nose? It seems like such an interesting, really offbeat way of hurting somebody.
Well, I was looking for a way to do something that I felt would appeal to your imagination in terms of just a tiny little violent act that was scary. I really didn't want to go into the kinds of violence that had been rife throughout films at that time. I wanted to have a minimal amount of violence, but I wanted to suggest that it was nevertheless a very violent world out there. So I thought of something that I would really hate to have happen to me, and it was that. And it seemed appropriate for a detective anyway.
What was very subversive about it was that it meant that Jack Nicholson, the leading man, had a bandage on his nose for half the movie. And even when he took the bandage off, he had a big cut and stitches on his nose.
Well, once again, in most movies, you can see people fight in a way that would have crushed skulls, created probably, you know, quadriplegics on with both combatants, and they emerge unscathed from the battle and continue to go out throughout the film with a bruise here or there, which disappears in the next scene. Well, in fact, that doesn't happen. I mean, if somebody gets hurt, it hurts. Just a tiny little slit in your nose can really smart, and it can affect the way you look and feel for weeks, and in this case, for the rest of the movie. It was just an attempt to just like Chinatown was an attempt to deal with a real crime that involved something as seemingly prosaic as land and water, that little act of violence was an attempt to suggest that you can really hurt people by doing almost nothing at all, just a tiny little slit of their nose.
I want to ask you a little bit about writing a climactic scene, a scene in which there's really a turning point in the story or in their character development. In Chinatown, the real turning point scene, or at least one of them, is when Faye Dunaway reveals that the woman whose identity she's been hiding is really her daughter as a result of an incestuous relationship. Her father had, the Faye Dunaway father had raped her when she was 15. And I want to just play a clip from this scene and then ask you a little bit about the considerations in writing this kind of climax.
I don't know what you are talking about. This is the craziest, the most insane thing.
Stop it! I'm going to make it easy for you. You were jealous. You had a fight. He fell. He hit his head. It was an accident. But his girl is a witness. So you had to shut her up. You don't have the guts to harm her, but you got the money to keep her mouth shut. Yes or no?
No!
Who is she? And don't give me that crap about your sister because you don't have a sister.
I'll tell you the truth.
Good. What's her name?
Catherine.
Catherine who?
She's my daughter.
I said I want the truth.
She's my sister. She's my daughter. My sister, my daughter.
I said I want the truth.
She's my sister and my daughter.
It's a really such a dramatic way of bringing across that revelation, and to have, especially with the slaps in between, you know, that's, I don't know if people can make that out in the clip that we heard. But can I ask you about planning that, writing that climax, and if you had written in the slaps, if you thought that that would add to the drama of the moment?
Well, yes, they were written in. I think that any revelation of any kind is only credible, particularly one that is shameful, at least whether or not there's any moral stigma attached to it. It certainly is embarrassing for the Faye Dunaway character to have to admit to it. And the only way you're going to believe that what she says is true is if she's reluctant to talk about it, and that's putting it mildly. I think that, as a general rule, anything that you want an audience to believe is something that a character has to reveal reluctantly. Any kind of free and easy revelation is one that I think we automatically suspect is not true. We just, you know, glibness is whether or not it is in fact true. It's certainly dramatically true that glibness is generally tantamount to insincerity.
Robert Towne, speaking to Terry Gross in 1988. In 1996, Terry spoke with Faye Dunaway, who starred as Jack Nicholson's conflicted client in Chinatown. It's a very famous role because of the secrets she keeps.
You had to construct your reactions in the film. So early on, we'd interpret your reactions as guilt.
Right.
But later on, we'd realize that you were just so pained by the truth.
Mm.
So what did you do with your body language and your face to convey this complex reaction that's going to mean something different to us later on in the film?
Well, it all had to be very subterranean, that's for starters. You had to not know what was going on with her. So anything you had to, like, really work in layers, you know. If some was scripted. For example, you remember when I lit a cigarette in Jack's office and one was already lit. So those kinds of things, and from that you knew that she was nervous about something that Jack was asking her, and Jack and the audience, by the way, had to know I was guilty or believe I was guilty. And I then had to play it for the truth. I had to play it because I knew the truth. I, as the character, knew the truth. You know, so that it was colored slightly, but you always had to, as the actress, remember that you had to fool them. You had to make them think that you were guilty.
No, the truth of the story is that there's a mysterious young girl in the film, and Nicholson is insisting, you know, tell me who she really is. What's your relationship to you? And the truth is, do you mind if I say what it is? I think most of our listeners have seen the film.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
Okay, the truth is that she's your daughter and your sister because she's your daughter through being raped by your own father.
Right.
So Nicholson is saying, so who is she? And you say...
Yeah, this is at the end of it where really we've all been kept guessing and wondering, and this is a crucial moment at the end. And it's the famous scene where I say, she's my daughter, and he slaps me. And I say, she's my sister, and he slaps me again. And then I say, she's my daughter and my sister. And then the scene moves on. That was an interesting scene because Jack didn't want to slap me, of course, you know. We tried the old phony thing of your hand stops just short of the face, you know, and then the face moves. And, you know, it wasn't working because he had to slap me a number of times. And I finally said, Jack, you're just going to have to hit me. And he said, you sure, Dread? He used to call me the Dreaded Dunaway sometimes. And I said, yeah, come on, let's do it. So we did. And it was the only thing that would have worked in that scene.
Did he hit you hard?
Pretty hard. Had to be real. Yeah, it had to be what his character would be doing. This character was at the end of his rope, and it was just gone driven crazy by this story and this woman and feeling that she had been lying to him, you know.
No, I believe the ending was debated, the ending of Chinatown, whether you should die or whether the father who raped you, played by John Huston, should die.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's a very unhappy, it's a very tragic ending because the perpetrator, you know, the real...
Yes.
The real bad guy here goes free, and the victim, gets shot in the eye.
It's a very Polanski ending, really. And it is a very painful ending, you know. And it's film noir. It's noir.
So what was the debate like about how it should end?
Well, I wasn't really a part of it. It was between Bob Town and
the screenwriter.
Jack, to some degree, yeah, the screenwriter, and Roman. And Roman won. I think Bob wanted me to live. And wanted Evelyn to live, but Roman really felt strongly that it should be twisted and she should be dead.
Now, how did you feel about it? Did you want your character to live or die? Which ending rang more true to you?
I, on a personal level, would always prefer them to live because the characters become your friends, and you really champion those characters. I mean, it's my job to defend that character, basically. But as a film, a student of film, I think Roman was right. I think it's more in keeping with the genre, and it's more tragic, and it was an Oedipal theme. You know, this was Oedipus, the great Greek hero, slept with his mother unbeknownst to him. It was predicted, and in the end put out his eyes, blinded himself because of the pain of his behavior. He couldn't live with what he'd done without punishing himself. And this character was Oedipal, too. That's why I insisted on the last moment in the film. Roman was going to let it go. He was going to let me be shot in the arm or somewhere else or the chest or something. And because he had forgotten to order the appliance that goes on the eye. This is kind of a rubber, you know, thing that you then make up, and it looks like a bullet's just gone into the eye. He'd forgotten to order it, and he said, well, that's okay. We'll just shoot you somewhere. And I said, no, we have to shoot me through the eye. I mean, that's the Oedipal thing. So it was something I was really fond of, and I thought it was an important moment. I thought it made the resonance of that moment would make the rest of the film. It just made it all, it gave it a bigger scope. And so anyway, we sat in the trailer, and I said, look, if we can do it, do you want to hear the story?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I said, look, if we can do it, my makeup man, Lee Harmon, if we can somehow do this, will you let us do it? And he sort of challengingly, as I recall, sneered at me and said, yes, go ahead and try. So Lee had the rubber nose of Kim Darby's double in his makeup kit. I promise you. And he put this thing on and made it work and really worked with it. He was a wonderful makeup man. And took about 4 hours one night, and we did it, and we came out, and it looked amazing.
Now, so the Kim Darby's double's nose was refashioned into a shot-up eye?
Yeah.
You know, the other reason why it works so well to get shot in the eye is, you know, your face, you're driving away when you get shot. And your face kind of hits the horn, and you hear this horn ringing.
Yeah.
And you know something's wrong, but you don't know why.
Yeah.
Then you realize, well, you've been shot in the face. So right. If you were shot in the arm,
yeah, no,
that horn wouldn't have happened, right?
Have to be somewhere in the head, I suppose, yeah.
Yeah. So that must
the
have been...
The horn was great, yeah.
That must have been pretty creepy also.
Yeah.
See yourself that way.
Yeah, it's a good moment, though.
Faye Dunaway, speaking with Terry Gross in 1996. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. If you're just joining us, we're looking at the American Film Institute's list released this week of the top 10 movies in 10 different genres. We're playing back some of Terry's conversations about those films. And now, from the category of epics, we start with Spartacus and its star and producer, Kirk Douglas. Spartacus, released in 1960, includes a very famous scene. The Romans order one of their prisoners, the slave rebellion leader known as Spartacus, to step forward. Kirk Douglas, as Spartacus, complies, but he's not alone.
Slaves you were, and slaves you remain. But the terrible penalty of crucifixion has been set aside on the single condition that you identify the body or the living person of the slave called Spartacus.
I'm Spartacus.
That's Spartacus from 1960. Kirk Douglas wrote in his autobiography that after starring in one period epic, The Vikings, he didn't want to make another. Yet he ended up not only starring in Spartacus, but producing it. When Terry spoke with Kirk Douglas in 1988, she asked him why.
I didn't want to make an epic. And one of the first things I said to my group, I said, look, if we do this picture Spartacus, let's make it as if it were a small picture. And to me, if you look at Spartacus again, you will find that the characters dominate the background. Most pictures, Ben-Hur and all that, the background is so enormous. But in Spartacus, Olivier, Lawton, Ustinov, Gene Simmons, the characters are stronger than the background, and that's what I try to do. In spite of the fact that it was an epic picture, I wanted the characters to be, for them to be larger than life.
You mentioned the characters and some of the actors. You ended up casting Gene Simmons in the role of Spartacus's lover and the woman who he has a baby with. And initially you didn't want to cast her because she's British, and you thought that that would ruin the linguistic pattern of the movie, and I'd love for you to explain what you meant by that.
Well, I have a very simple... For example, when I did The Vikings, all the Vikings are Americans. We have a rougher pattern of speech. The English have a more elegant pattern of speech, so that makes it work. In Spartacus, you'll notice that all the aristocratic Romans are English.
That's right. They're great,
the slaves,
great stage actors. Great British
right.
stage
the,
actors.
The slaves, like myself, were Americans.
Not only that, ethnic, right? Jewish, Italian. You, Jewish. Tony Curtis, Italian. No, Tony Curtis is Jewish too, actually, isn't
that's
he?
That's right.
Yeah, that's right. I always forget that.
But it doesn't matter. You see, it's just that Americans have a rougher speech pattern. For example, I often think that Shakespeare very often is better played when it's done in the United States, because those beautiful lines take on a rougher quality that I think Shakespeare really intended.
So the slaves have the rough quality, and the Romans have the more genteel, educated, refined sound.
Exactly. Of course.
Now, is this intentional? Is this standard, or is this just something you wanted to do?
I don't know. I never thought of it that way. It was just, you know,
okay.
My way of looking at the picture.
Since we're talking about Spartacus, let me play a clip from the movie. And this is toward the end of the first half of the film. Remember, this movie had an intermission. And Spartacus and many other slaves have escaped from slavery. And after they've escaped, many of the slaves are just drinking wine. They're having Romans fight each other as if the Romans were slaves. And Spartacus is saying, what are you doing with your lives? You should be doing something more productive. And he suggests that they actually fight the Roman Empire.
What are we, Crixus? What are we becoming, Romans? Have we learned nothing? What's happening to us? We look for wine when we should be hunting bread.
When you've got wine, you don't need bread.
It can't just be a gang of drunken raiders.
What else can we be?
Gladiators. An army of gladiators. There's never been an army like that. One gladiator's worth any two Roman soldiers that ever lived.
We beat the Roman guards here, but a Roman army's a different thing. They fight different than we do, too.
We can beat anything they send against us if we really want to.
It takes a big army for that, Spartacus.
We'll have a big army. Once we're on the march, we'll free every slave in every town and village. Can anybody get a bigger army than that?
That's right. Once we cross the Alps, we're safe.
Nobody can cross the Alps. Every pass is defended by its own legion.
There's only one way to get out of this country. The sea.
What good is the sea if you have no ships?
The Cilician pirates have ships. They're at war with Rome. Every Roman galley that sails out of Brundusium pays tribute to them.
They've got the biggest fleet in the world. I was a galley slave with them. Give them enough gold and they'll take you anywhere.
We haven't got enough gold.
Take every Roman we capture and warm his back a little. We'll have gold all right.
Spartacus is right. Let's hire these pirates and march straight to Brundusium.
Well, they get their army, and you, as Spartacus, lead them against the Roman army. I think the battle scene in Spartacus, where the slave army and the Roman army fight, is one of the most interestingly choreographed movie battle scenes. The slaves are massed in almost a checkerboard formation. There are people in the slave and the Roman army as far as you can see. It is this huge vista of people. I'm wondering what your most vivid memory of being in the middle of all of that is.
Well, you see, all of that was historically accurate. We studied how Romans fought, you know, and how they arranged their armies. And, of course, that was a scene. We shot the entire picture in the United States, except for those scenes, which we shot in Spain, because you needed so many people, and we used lots of Spanish soldiers. The battle scenes were all shot in Spain because it needed thousands of people.
There is a scene at the end that is a mass crucifixion, and you're one of the many actors on the cross at the end of the movie. And I'd really like to know how you were attached to the cross so that you could hang there without really hurting yourself.
Well, as a matter of fact, playing that scene, we learned an awful lot about crucifixion. We learned that it would be impossible to be crucified the way very often you see a crucifixion. The body would sag right down. But to make our scenes effective, it was very easy. Every cross had a bicycle seat that just kept the body up high enough so that you wouldn't be sagging down in a very unattractive position.
Kirk Douglas, speaking to Terry Gross in 1988. In 1991, Terry spoke with another star from Spartacus, Tony Curtis. He played a slave boy who served the leader of the Roman army, played by Laurence Olivier, but who later joined the slave uprising and saw Spartacus as a father figure. Terry spoke with Tony Curtis when a newly restored version of Spartacus was released, including a previously censored scene. Curtis, as the slave, is attending to Olivier, the Roman officer, in the bath. Curtis gives his master a robe, and Olivier begins talking about the splendor of Rome.
There, boy, is Rome. The might, the majesty, the terror of Rome. There is the power that bestrides the known world like a colossus. No man can withstand Rome. No nation can withstand her. How much less a boy? There's only one way to deal with Rome, Antoninus. You must serve her. You must abase yourself before her. You must grovel at her feet. You must love her. Isn't that so, Antoninus?
Well, you get the point there. Olivier is suggesting that Curtis should not only give in to the power of Rome, but to the sexual power of his master. It's very metaphoric. The whole thing is so...
Well, he doesn't come out and say, I want to stick it to you, dear. I mean, you know, he talks about snails and oysters. It's a clever way of... Or they think it's an artistic way of doing it. I would have much preferred the scene were a little more blatant in its approach, because it would have been a lot more logical and perhaps a lot more realistic. But somebody thought it would be kind of fanciful to talk of fish. I really don't know why.
Well, I actually have the script from that scene in front of me, so let me read some of it. I won't pretend like I'm you or Olivier.
Well, please.
But Crassus, played by Olivier, asks you a bunch of questions. He asks you, do you steal, Antoninus? And you say, no, master. And he says, do you lie? And you say, no, master. And he says, have you ever dishonored the gods? And you say, no. He says, do you refrain from these vices out of respect for the moral virtues? And you say, yes. Then he asks you if you eat oysters and if you eat snails. And you say that you eat oysters, but you don't eat snails. And he asks you if you consider the eating of oysters to be moral and the eating of snails to be immoral, and so on. And then he confesses that he eats both.
Yes.
It's kind of like swinging both ways subtext here. So did you and Olivier really talk through the scene before you did it? You know,
absolutely not. There's nothing to talk through. There I am in a bikini.
Yeah, you're wearing your bathing trunks.
Standing over him while he sits in a bikini in a tub. I mean, it doesn't really take a lot of internal dialogue to describe or even know what's going on.
Was there a big fight with the censors over the scene?
No, there wasn't. I don't think the studio had any plans to really put it in, you know?
Well, whose idea was it to put it in?
Well, it had to go in. Larry, Olivier, and I wouldn't have done the other scenes had not that scene been shot. See, it was written in the script, and before the picture was made, they decided that it's not going to end up in the movie. So we shot that scene, but only on the protest. Larry and I told the production department and the producer of the film that we would not be interested in doing the second scene unless we had that first scene.
So did either of you take the lead in objecting to the scene being cut or in insisting that
no, we both knew what the relationship between Crassus and Antoninus was, and we both insisted that the scenes had to be done the way the script was written. So we got them to shoot that scene, but they never recorded the sound. You know, they discarded the sound because they knew that it would probably never be in the film. Larry and I hoped it would be, and when we saw the final cut and realized they had cut it, we knew that, you know, it was hurting the performances, but there was nothing we could do about it. And here we are 30-some-odd years later, and it's back in the movie. And I'm sure if Larry were alive, he'd really be happy to know that.
Now, the scene that we're talking about had no sound. So that means that you had a dub in the sound when they decided to restore it.
Yes.
And Olivier is no longer with us. How did you...
Well, I did Olivier, and they got somebody else to do me.
Right.
They got Anthony Hopkins to do Olivier.
Tony Curtis, speaking with Terry Gross in 1991. He has a new memoir called American Prince, coming out in October. Our last selection from the American Film Institute's list of 10 top 10 films is Lawrence of Arabia, which tops the AFI's list of epic movies. This 1962 David Lean film stars Peter O'Toole in the title role, one of many historically based parts he's played in a career that also includes such movies as Beckett and The Lion in Winter. Terry spoke with Peter O'Toole in 1993 and asked him about the way Lawrence of Arabia, with its vast panoramic views, was filmed.
There are a lot of scenes in Lawrence of Arabia where the camera seems to be almost several miles away from the people being shot.
Yeah, you're quite right. And that soul on the camel, all those many, many miles away, is invariably me.
Yes. Well, what was it like to know that you were being shot by at such a great distance? And, of course, they could zoom in with the lens, you know, for a closer shot. But that must have been pretty disorienting.
Initially, one was peeved. I remember David Lean saying to me... I had a stuntman doing it, all those shots that were miles and miles away. And David said, look at the lens, Peter, look at the stuntman. So I did, and he said, you see, no poetry. So I found myself being the poet, and I was the one bouncing up and down miles and miles away. But it was all right. I had a transistor radio plugged into my ears, and I had a cigarette going, and I had a little bottle of something in the saddlebag. I was quite comfy. And the man who taught me to ride and who did all those shots, of those amazing shots of the desert, was a man called Kutaifun Abu Tai, who was the grandson of the man whom Anthony Quinn played, Abu Abu Tai.
Oh.
Aouda Abu Tai. There was a strange thing. When the film was collected together again and the bits that had been missing were restored and glued back into place, we were in New York for the opening, David Lean and Omar Sharif and Alec Guinness and Anthony Quinn, the ones of us who were still alive. And having been introduced to the audience again, they were expecting to see this dark-haired beauty, Omar Sharif, and this blonde-haired little god, me, and I came toddling. We were like the Chelsea pensioners, these ancient old warriors came waddling into the spotlight. Then the lights went down and the music began, and there was a place which had been apportioned for us VIPs to sit, but I didn't. I just sat down on the front, all alone on the front row, just as I used to do as a child. And boom, on came the film. And when we came to those shots of the desert, I wasn't looking at the picture. I was just remembering what went on. Oh, that was the day that so-and-so broke his neck, yes. That was the day when so-and-so. And we came to this huge shot of the desert. And it's a scene when one Bedouin says, tomorrow, good riding. And it cuts to this huge panorama of the desert, the painted desert, the many colours, and the two of us galloping on camels. Well, that was Kutaifun Abu Tai, who was killed in the late 60s. And I was very moved.
What was it like to be in the middle of some of those chaotic battle scenes? Is it pretty frightening knowing that even though it's just a movie, things can still go wrong?
Well, there was the charge at Aqaba, which I shall never forget, because we were then in Spain. We'd left Aqaba, and we'd built Aqaba in Spain. I know, this is the logic of filmmaking. And it was downhill, on shale, about a mile and a half to the cardboard Aqaba we'd built, cardboard minarets. And we'd imported from Morocco plough camels. Now, your camel may look just like a great humped brute to you, but there are fine distinctions. In Arabia proper, we'd had camels called dhaluls, which are bred for racing purposes, and they're bought in Damascus, and they cost a great deal of money. And here we were with Moroccan plough camels who had never, ever had a thing on their backs and had never, ever gone quickly in their poor little lives. And I thought, this is going to be a bit tasty. So I looked at Omar, a gambling man, and said, what are you going to do? He said, I've been working out the odds. I said, have you really? He said, yes, I've been working out the odds about whether or not I fall off the camel or whether the camel falls over. And I've decided that the odds are very strongly on me falling off the camel. So I said, yes. He said, so I've decided that I'm going to tie myself on. I thought, really? Tie yourself onto a camel? Because we were surrounded by 400 horses. We had to lead, Omar and I had to lead, on a handful of, a dozen or so, 20, 50 camels, with 400 horses galloping behind us. And we had to lead this charge. And Omar said, I'm going to tie myself on. I thought, well, I don't want to tie myself on. Not really. Tie yourself on a camel? No. I said, no, I'm going to get drunk. He said, oh, I'm going to get drunk too. So we both got a bottle of brandy and we shoved it into milk and we swallowed back the milky brandy, which made us feel not a lot of pain, hopped on our beasts and did it. And I was described in one newspaper having a look of messianic ecstasy on my face. what it was terror compounded with slightly being a little bit pissed. It was rather nice, really, on the whole. And we made it. We got to the other end all right. Right to the sea, and I stood on my camel, we stood in the water, and I looked, and to my right was Omar, and he was still tied to the camel, but he was hanging on upside down.
Was it easier to stay on the camel being slightly inebriated? I'd think it would be harder.
Look, the prospect was being trampled to death by 400 horses.
Yeah.
So it seemed to be, if one was going to be trampled to death by 400 horses, at least have a smile on your face, I thought.
Peter O'Toole, speaking with Terry Gross in 1993. The complete list of the American Film Institute's 10 top 10 films was released this week. The latest TV series to be adapted for the big screen is Get Smart, based on the Mel Brooks' Buck Henry secret agent parody that ran from 1965 to 1970. The TV show starred Don Adams as secret agent Maxwell Smart. In the new film, Max is played by Steve Carell and his partner, Agent 99, by Anne Hathaway. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
The movie of Get Smart is a hoot, with at least a 2-to-1 ratio of good gags to clunkers. But it's not, for better or worse, Get Smart. The 60s sitcom, conceived by Mel Brooks and Buck Henry, made hay of ridiculous, malfunctioning secret agent gadgets. But at heart, it wasn't a James Bond parody. It was an American espionage reworking of The Pink Panther. Like Peter Sellers' Inspector Clouseau, Don Adams' agent Maxwell Smart was a boob who fancied himself a suave super sleuth. He thought he was 007. His lack of self-awareness could pay dividends, though. With the aid of his more competent female partner, Agent 99, he triumphed over foes who were fatally rational, too easily flummoxed by his idiocy. Director Peter Siegel's star-packed, big-budget update is bursting with gadget shtick and all the treasured catchphrases. Would you believe? Missed it by that much. But the Max of Steve Carell just isn't the fool we knew and loved. Carell is delightful, he usually is, but he's delightful as Steve Carell, a mild-mannered dweeb with occasional flights of grandiosity and an abundance of self-consciousness. He's plucky, but easily rattled. He begins as a desk-bound nerd at his spy agency, Control, a painstaking analyst who dreams of going into the field, but looks puny and hapless beside the cool and muscular Agent 23, played by Dwayne Johnson, a.k.a. The Rock. Now, it's a valid question whether we'd want another obtuse Don Adams-like Agent 86. Get Smart, the sitcom, was often a one-joke affair and got tedious fast, whereas Carell's starry-eyed geek has room for nuance, for emotional growth. You can make a case for both Maxes. Me, I kind of miss the boob. Agent 99 has been altered more shrewdly. The problem with the sitcom's Barbara Feldon was that even when she saved Max's life, her mushy subtext, very much of its day, was to preserve his delusions of potency. Here, she's a bratty show-off, a perfectly cast Anne Hathaway, who's dressed in Chanel to the 99s. Like most young actresses, Hathaway has dropped too many pounds. In a couple of shots, her cheeks have sunk so deep they can barely contain her big teeth. But the sleekness, the hard Chanel lines, the blacks and bright greens against that ivory skin. After this and The Devil Wears Prada, she must have fashion designers camping outside her co-op. The plot centers on an attack on Control headquarters. Max is one of the few employees whose identity has not been compromised, which leads to a promotion. As the newly dubbed Agent 86, he tries to deceive Chaos Kingpin Siegfried, played by an icy Terrence Stamp, and his sidekick, Starker, that's Ken Davidian, who memorably nude-wrestled Sacha Baron Cohen in the Borat movie, and thankfully keeps his clothes on here.
Who are you?
My name is Nudnik Shpilkas. Who are you?
I am Siegfried.
I understand that you're the man to see if someone is interested in acquiring items of a nuclear nature.
How do I know you're not Control?
If I were Control, you'd already be dead.
If you were Control, you'd already be dead.
Well, neither of us is dead, so I'm obviously not from Control.
That actually makes sense.
That exchange is actually below the movie's standard, and Stamp doesn't get a lot to do. It's good that Siegfried is no longer an ethnic joke like in the TV series, but now he's not much of anything. The thing is, though, there are so many elements in the mix that Get Smart never bogs down. As the chief, the straight man for Max, Alan Arkin shows off some of the best timing in movies. There are more fisticuffs, chases, and shootouts than in many genuine action films. The best scene, though, makes the case for elegance, even in slapstick comedy. It's a bit at a hoity-toity Russian black tie affair, where 99, looking like a couture Mata Hari, waltzes off with the baddie host, and jealous Max hits the dance floor with an obese young woman, played by Lindsay Hollister. It turns out that Hollister is enchantingly light on her feet, and Max goes with her, even lifts her with supreme ease. The old Maxwell Smart wouldn't have had the largeness of spirit for that dance. At his best, Carell makes nebbishy simplicity a state of grace.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.